Welcome to the Songs of Note podcast, where we talk about the songs we love and the stories behind them. I'm your host, Ryan Gregg.
Hey, thank you so much for joining me for the Songs of Note podcast today. This is a podcast where we talk about music, stories behind songs, all things music. And, you know, something that I was looking back over episodes, and we really haven't talked about a ton of 80s bands or 80s songs looking back. There's been a lot of 60s and 70s bands, and then a lot of 90s bands, and then current bands. And so really want to give a shout out to my friend Bill Victor, who was the one who turned me on to this book that just came out. And it is by Annie Zaleski, and it's on the 33 and a third series, and it's on Duran Duran's Rio. And I don't know if you've seen these 33 and a third books, but they're small. They're like the size of your hand, and then they're usually, 200 pages or less. And it's just the story behind a classic album, which I love the series. We did an episode on Pearl Jam's Versus, and that was from the 33 and a third series, and it's just a cool series. So Annie Zaleski is the author. She was kind enough to come on the show. She's an author, a music journalist. She's written for The Guardian, NPR Music. You can find her on Twitter at Annie Zaleski. And just really enjoyed hearing her perspective on the album and the stories behind the band. I talked about inside the interview a little bit about my own personal weird experience with this album, because I knew the hits and I didn't know the full album. And so trying to step into an album 40 years after it came out and not having any of the cultural context for it, it took me a bunch of listens to try to step into, like, I love this song. This song, that's kind of weird. This song, yeah, that's good. These two, killer. Full disclosure, this was a weird process for me, processing, reading the book, watching the documentary, learning the album, and then having the interview. So all that has happened within 1 week. So I've been in Duran Duran world more than I ever have. And, it is a classic album, and there's lots of things written about it. And I would say I certainly have a better appreciation for the record after talking with Annie and after spending a lot of time with it myself this week. Songs on the album are like Hungry Like the Wolf, Rio, Save a Prayer. Anyway, some great songs. But I want to give a shout out to Bill Victor for suggesting the book and for talking through his experience with the book. Want to give another shout out to my friend Rob and say thanks for talking through his experience with the band and getting to hear them. And hey, one of the best things about this podcast is connecting on social media. So if you come follow me at Songs of Note on Instagram, or you can find me on Twitter and Facebook, I love connecting with people. I love hearing from people saying, hey, like that episode, or have you heard this band? And so one of the guys I've connected with is named Josh, and Josh, I want to give you a shout out. He just had a baby and let me know about it. And I knew that it was coming. He let me know it happened and said, it's been amazing. So man, that's amazing. So yeah, good to connect. And I think that's it, but just appreciate you guys listening. Let's head on over to the interview with Annie Zaleski now. Well, hey, I'm so excited to have Annie Zaleski here to join me today. Annie, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, I'm excited to chat with you. I was glad that you were willing to hop on a call and talk about Duran Duran. This is a band that, you know, I've always heard growing up, and I'm curious what was the thing that made you want to write this book about them, about Rio?
That's a good question. I'm also a longtime Duran Duran fan, going back I think nearly 30 years at this point, since I was a teenager. Rio is in their catalog, and Duran Duran's catalog looms so large. You know, it's their second record. It's one of those records that doesn't have a bad song on it. You can play it from front to back, back to front, and it just completely works. There's strong songwriting. There's unique textures. I mean, it's a perfect record.
So I had an interesting interaction this past week that I've never had with the record. I'm going to give full disclosure here, because I want your opinion. You grew up listening to them in like the 90s. Is that what you were saying?
Yes, correct.
Okay, so me too. So it sounds like we're in a similar time frame. So for me, I grew up like knowing the hits. Hungry Like the Wolf, Rio, loved them. And then I didn't know like this full record very well. And so then your book helped expand about, okay, what was happening? What was going on here? But I felt like I couldn't connect to it in some way. And it felt like there was a disconnect between like, gosh, I don't have any memories of these songs. This is like created 40 years ago in a time capsule, and I don't have any personal memories to it. And I had a bunch of conversations with people this week because I was really wrestling with it. I was like, what am I missing about? I know the songs are good and I know the hits are great, but I wasn't connecting fully with it. And a couple of the guys I talked to who just, you know, said it's one of their favorite albums, said it's really the cultural context of like going through high school or whatever it was at the time. And this was the band. This is the band at the time that, you know, they weren't just pretty boys. They were guys that were writing awesome songs and they were a killer band. But I'm curious. So for you, when did you get into like, did you get into the full album in the 90s, or do you understand my random experience also?
No, I'm nodding my head because I did actually experience Rio when I was a teenager in high school.
Okay.
I ended up, you know, so in the 90s, you know, people, you know, Duran Duran had all these comeback hits. They had Ordinary World, Done, the Wedding Album, they were on MTV. They'd kind of risen back to the status they were in the 80s. But at the same time, there were alternative radio was kind of coming into play, and they were more of an influence. And there were all these retro lunches, these flashback lunches, and the 80s were cool.
Yes.
So Duran Duran was also getting a boost there. And that was sort of my entryway. You know, I went to my library in my hometown and I took Rio out of the library and I dubbed it onto a cassette, which I still have today. I've shared this online.
That's awesome.
And so I remember being a kid and, you know, obviously it was well over a decade after the record came out, but I was a teenager just really connecting with it.
That's
Think there is something, I think there is something to that, that there just is something about this record, about how it conveys possibility and optimism, is that when it hits you at a specific time in your life and you're a specific age, it really does just have an impact.
That's cool that you actually did experience it as a teenager in another decade. I mean, that totally changes. I totally see what you're saying. Well, for people who are hearing about this, you know, album, and can you give a refresher on what was the, like, kind of the musical landscape when this record came out? We're talking early 80s. Like, what were the other bands and the sounds that they were dealing with at the time?
So it's so interesting because when Duran Duran came out, and they're from Birmingham, England, the UK was like completely different than what was going on in America. You know, the UK, they embraced kind of, I mean, I guess you would say it's new wave, but it's, you know, Adam Ant was big. Culture Club was starting to come into play, Spandau Ballet. So there were all of these new sounds, these kind of post Bowie bands, I guess I would say. You know, Bowie was obviously still a, you know, formative artist, but he was acting in the early 80s. So all of these groups that were inspired by Bowie and Roxy Music, huge in the UK. In the US, things were so different. When Duran Duran came out, it was basically like the 70s had never ended. You know, you had classic rock. I mean, what we now know is classic rock. So, you know, Bob Seger, Steve Miller Band, April Wine, Rush, you know, all of those bands were still very popular. It was still kind of straight ahead rock and roll, basically. Mm. And so Duran Duran, and I've said this a lot, it was like they were from another planet when they crash landed in America, because they had these beautiful suits they were wearing. You know, some of them were wearing makeup. They had dyed hair. They made no mistake that glamour was something they were going for. And that was like, you know, completely antithetical to the bands who would show up on stage wearing, you know, flannel shirts and jeans. It was like, you know, very casual. And so Duran Duran's sound as well kind of reflected that. You know, they had Nick Rhodes keyboards were very prominent in the mix. And he was very inspired by Brian Eno and people like that, who only really had cult followings in America. And so they were really, really interesting. They were a dance band. And, you know, when they came out, MTV was just kind of starting to have an impact. And so, you know, Culture Club and the Human League were had some hits. And so, but it was, you know, not very, you know, synth friendly. It was more one hit wonders, you know, Gary Numan and Soft Cell and pop music and things like that. They were more the exception rather than the rule.
Well, and it was interesting in the book, you talked about how for a lot of people, and I'm going to phrase this wrong, so please correct me, but it was basically that a lot of people were hearing music like this in clubs for the first time rather than the radio, which is a foreign concept to us. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it was, the time was so different. And so it's so interesting kind of going back to that, because I think now everyone, you have anything that you want to hear at your fingertips.
Right.
Whether that's, YouTube on streaming service and things like that. Back then, it was like, that's where radio was very conservative. And so, the way that bands became popular was having a radio hit. But radio was like not at all adventurous. Huh. So where was it? Where were the cool things happening? In the clubs. So you would go, and obviously, New York and LA popular, but even in, every city in America, bigger cities, they had this whole kind of, network of clubs that would kind of play cool things. And so that's kind of where, Duran Duran's first record came out in 1981 and didn't do a ton in America, but it was really popular in the dance clubs. They were a dance band. And so, yeah, that's where, like, if you were hip in 1981 and 1982, that's where you were going. That's where you were hanging out and going dancing.
That's interesting. Well, okay. So you set the stage there. The first album came out. They didn't hit big on the first album, right? In the U.S. But they felt the challenge of it, and they were ready to tackle the United States and to conquer the world, really. Can you talk about, there's always the sophomore slump is what everybody dreads. How big of a challenge was it for the band to come up with this material, and how did they go about actually succeeding in conquering the radio?
So what's interesting is that, the band themselves, when I talked to them for the book, they were like, coming up with the material was actually not that bad. They had some things kind of hanging around. They were really, because they were touring a lot, they were really creative. They were really in a good place as a band right now, back then. The issue was everyone else catching up to them. The UK was like, we totally get it. Rio came out super popular right away, all good. But when you went and looked at America was like, what is going on here? So you had some, you had some radio stations that supported them, and, and college radio was always very supportive of Duran Duran. And, you had the big alternative stations that were, but that was it. And so they were like any young band trying to make it big. They came over to America. They hit the road. They did some club dates. They ended up opening for Blondie. They did some of these other one-off shows. Like, they played a show with Split Enz in New York, this Dr. Pepper festival. And so they had all of these like really kind of cool things. They were, the first band on a huge bill of bands, just, playing their like short set. So they tried to do that. And that made a few inroads, but they basically, obviously, because like I said before, radio was the only way to get a hit. So what they ended up doing with their label is they ended up having remixes done. They hired a guy named David Kirschenbaum, who had actually discovered Joe Jackson, but he really understood kind of British bands and how they kind of operated. He was very, very smart about that. So they remixed Hungry Like the Wolf, and everyone liked it. And so they reissued that. Tried and, and it got a little bit of inroads again. But what really did it is going back to the dance clubs. And so their record label and Duran Duran decided to release what they called the Carnival EP, which was this 4-song EP that had danceable mixes, a couple of things that had been released, a couple of new remixes, and they put that in the market. And that finally kind of helped everything pick up, because radio was like, wow, this stuff sounds really good. It sounded fresh. They kind of, everything was balanced a little bit. So the guitars were maybe a little higher in the mix. It was a little bit more, it's tough to even say Americanized, because it doesn't sound very American music oriented still, but it was just enough that radio was like, yeah, we can play this. So that kind of started getting things in motion. And then that's what kind of started, and Carnival started selling very well. And then by the end of 1982 and into 1983, Hungry Like the Wolf finally took off at rock radio. Then everything happened. But it was a long time. Rio came out in May of 1982. And it was a long, long uphill climb in America to get them popular.
Well, you mentioned that was an uphill battle. And I feel like in the book you talk about it was also an uphill battle, kind of trying to win over the label. Like, there was some description in there that some of the guys at even the label were kind of turning their nose up to the band. How difficult do you think that was, trying to convey that what they were doing was good and trying to convince a label to get behind it even more, because they really needed the money to support it on radio and stuff. But I'm curious about the battles they faced with the record label itself.
I mean, I mentioned, you know, so they were on, and this is one of the weird things that it's also one of those things that you go back now and it's very strange, is that Duran Duran were signed to EMI. And, you know, now back then, the label structure was very, very different. And it's so complicated. I didn't even get into it very much in the book, because it's one of those things that most people would just be like, it's so complicated. So basically, they were on Harvest Records in America, which was kind of an EMI like offshoot. But it was distributed, and there was marketing promotion help from Capitol Records. So there were all of these different people, and Capitol Records, of course, as anyone knows, is this very, you know, famous label and very, very, you know, very kind of storied and has a storied history. Mm-hmm. But yet, you know, Harvest Records was like the cool label. That's where all the UK artists went. And so there was this weird kind of balance there. But Capitol was very old school. And I mean, they are the ones with Bob Seger and Steve Miller and April Wine. Like, they totally knew how to like market these, like, you know, straightforward rock bands that were very popular, you know, in the Midwest, you know, very kind of meat and potatoes, rock and roll. Mm-hmm. But Duran Duran, I mean, they were so different. It was a completely, you know, they were popular at different markets. They had a different fan base. They had a different, obviously they had a predominantly female fan base too, which was also totally different. So there were just all of these different things. And, you know, there was still kind of, we talked about, you know, the 70s was still hanging on. There's definitely that bias. There was that bias against, you know, Duran Duran, you know, were glamorous and they looked very British, but they were wearing makeup, you know, men wearing makeup. You know, you say you get in front of a certain label executive and it's just like, what is going on here? So there was, you know, a little bit of that element too, which is very old school music industry. So, you know, and they did have their supporters though. And that was one of the most gratifying things doing this book, is, you know, tracking down people who said, you know, I really believed in them. You know, so Duran Duran definitely had some champions on their side and people who were like, you know, no, this, I absolutely see the greatness of this band. And it was just a matter of trying to convince other people and then making sure that, you know, it got in front of the right people and things like that.
That's interesting. Man, 40 years ago, you know, like you said, things have changed so much, but that is interesting to hear it put like that, all the things that they went through. What about Hungry Like the Wolf? What were the things that you learned about this song, or that you found most interesting? Like, to me, this is, if I had to pick one Duran Duran song, it's probably this one, as like my favorite. And it's just so unique. That chorus is so good. Were there any stories that came off of that song, or how they wrote it or recorded it, that struck you?
I mean, I think one of the most interesting things is that, you know, you think about when you hear stories over the years of, you know, people, you know, writing hit songs, and sometimes people labor over them and other times it comes together really fast. Mm-hmm. Hungry Like the Wolf was the latter category. You know, it was one of those songs that, as legend has it, the band, they wrote it in London. They basically had demo time at a studio, and they had been out really late the night before because they're young kids and they're like enjoying London nightlife. I mean, I would do that too. I completely get it. And they rolled up to the studio. Nick Rhodes mentioned he was hungover, and, you know, they all just kind of started fiddling around with equipment and saying, what are we finding here? Just kind of dabbling in things. And it just kind of came together. You know, he came up with some stuff. Andy Taylor came up with this amazing guitar riff. You know, the rhythm section came in with stuff. And then Simon had his lyrics. And it was just, it came together easily. And it's so funny to think about that now, because that is, I think, their most well-known song, their most popular song. And it's a perfect pop song. And it sounds effortless, maybe because they wrote it effortlessly. So I think that was probably just hearing about how it came together and how easy it was, you know. There's no grand story behind it, no grand, you know, secret behind it. It was just a song that, you know, that came together. And that just really illustrates what fantastic songwriters they are, and how, you know, just how talented and in sync they were at that moment.
Well, and you're touching on something that I feel like I realized in myself, is like, I really love the dark backstory, or I love, you know, the person with fighting this, or they were dealing with these demons and then they rose above it. And this isn't really that story. This is that these guys were good songwriters and they went and did it and everybody liked it. Like, kind of, that's like, exactly. Right. In a really bad synopsis. But what I feel like I've appreciated more since reading your book, and I watched the documentary on the album and just listened to the album, over and over, is that it takes a unique skill to be able to make a pop song interesting and invoke emotion into it when you're dealing with electronic instruments. You know what I mean? Like those kind of notes and noises or may not evoke the human emotion, but I think they were able to hit on a thing that people love and you love to get behind. You love to sing those songs. I feel like the record comes across in a very like self-aware way. They're very aware of the sound that they're making, the sonic choices that they're making. This is an album that could have been released in 1970. This is a stamped 80s sounding album. Would you agree with that?
I would, you know, but what's interesting to me is that I think unlike other 80s records, it's aged better, you know, and I think John Taylor touched on this a little bit in the book that, you know, as Duran Duran, as the decade went on, like many bands, they, you know, really embraced more technology on, you know, the production and the instrumentation side. But this was like the last record where it was basically like, you know, the five of them on their instruments and in the studio kind of writing together. And so I think it's closely associated with the 80s, but I think it also kind of transcends the decade because it doesn't, you know, you think of some of the production and some of the goofy things that different other bands did during the decade,
right?
Whether that's like, you know, with keyboards or synthesizers or, you know, electronic drums and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You hear that, you're like, yeah, that's 1986. Like you can just like almost date it. But this record, like it, and I think this is why it resonates with so many people still, is that it sounds, you know, it's of the decade, but like I said, it also transcends it. And so, and I think partly why I think it's also so associated with the 80s is the album cover because of the smiling Rio girl, as they put it, from Patrick Nagel, because that's so, his style is so associated with the 80s and just his art in terms of the first half of the decade, especially. So I think that has a little bit to do with it too, but you know, I don't know, you know, it's an interesting case. And I think it's been very interesting going back and listening to it, you know, across the decades and especially now doing this book, because I hear of so many things that are so different now. It has a lot more depth than a lot of other 80s records too, I think.
That's, you know, really like, well put. Yeah. Keep going.
No, that I think, you know, I mean, you listened, you know, the biggest thing I learned, you know, I learned this very early on as a music fan that, you know, there's some great 80s singles. You're like, yeah, this is awesome. And then you buy the entire record. And there's a lot of filler. Like you're like, oh, yes. You know, all right. So this is, you know, I think I need to trade this in. Mm-hmm. But you know, this and that was very common because, you know, bands, if they released 45s or they had a really popular video and they needed to quickly kind of cobble something together, and they didn't necessarily, you know, they a lot of them also relied on technology rather than songwriting. And you know, Rio also really stands tall, I think, because, you know, as we talked about, the band were songwriters at heart, and they still are songwriters at heart. And so, you know, that's above all, you know, they made sure that they had good songs, and then everything else kind of came from there.
I love that you mentioned Joy Division, which I'm a huge fan of. And I believe you were saying that Simon was a big fan of theirs. The more I listened to this, I kept thinking, is Duran Duran like a more marketable version of Joy Division with major chords? That's what I thought after I was listening more and more. I was like, it's not the moody, brooding Joy Division, but you can hear, I feel like in the the way that he sings the vocals, you can hear that influence a little bit. Do you agree?
You know, and that was one of my actually the favorite quotes that I got from the band, you know, because, you know, I've been such a fan for so long, and it been, you know, and John Taylor was like, yeah, Simon Le Bon, his favorite band is Joy Division. And I think 95% of the people, if you tell that to, they would give you a look like, what are you talking about?
Right.
Joy Division and Duran Duran seem like they're, you know, polar opposites.
Totally.
But, but there really is something to that. You know, Simon is, his lyrics are very surreal, as many people pointed out. And there is this kind of this moodiness and this darkness and this philosophical existential bent to them. You know, there's, nothing is ever very straightforward. There's a lot more questions than answers in his lyrics. And I think that has a lot to do with Joy Division. And he, you know, he doesn't shy away from that darkness either. You know, they're very honest. They come from the heart. You know, I think he's even said sometimes, I'm not 100% sure, you know, a lot of times where this stuff is coming from, but he just kind of rolls with it. And so I think there's so much to that. And, you know, Simon at some point last year tweeted that he got to see a double bill of Joy Division and The Cure. and like different things connected in my head.
I'm my gosh.
So much more sense now. And where's my time machine? Can I go to that gig too?
Well, yeah. That was funny because I would have never connected Joy Division to Duran Duran's sound. But once you said it, it was like, oh, he's phrasing things in the way that the Joy Division does a little bit. So I love that you brought that up. I also love the story about Paul McCartney and the band running into him at the studio. Can you talk about that a little bit?
This is one of my favorite things, and this has come up. You know, it's so funny. I even say this in the book that, you know, everybody, because it's 40 years later, remembers, you know, the record sessions a little differently. But everyone mentions Paul McCartney showing up. So he was at Duran Duran recorded at Air Studios in London, which no longer exists, but it was owned by George Martin, who, of course, is the Beatles, mm-hmm. was the yeah. Beatles producer. And Paul happened to be recording at that time. And, you know, if you're a kid growing up in England, you know, you love the Beatles. And so obviously the Duran Duran liked the Beatles. But Paul would just kind of pop by, you know, and John's book, you know, he, I think, mentions that, you know, they like, you know, they played some music maybe, but whatever it was, Paul was really encouraging to them. And that stood out because, I mean, people forget how young Duran Duran was at the time.
Right.
They were like, you know,
19 to 23, yeah. Right? Isn't that
what exactly. And so when you're 21 and your musical hero is just like giving you a thumbs up, like, wow. Okay.
Yeah. No
so that. Joke. And so he, you know, he dropped by and I just thought that was such a cool little detail. I just thought that was just, you know, it's something that really just kind of, it kind of shows where Duran Duran was at the time that they were still awed by their heroes. But it also really shows you that, you know, hey, you know, Paul was being a little bit, you know, encouraging, you know, and that really meant a lot to the band. And, you know, you're trying to make a good second record and you're trying to push your career forward and to get a little bit of a nudge and like, you know, you're going in the right direction from your hero. Like that's big. And yeah. I just thought that was cool.
Oh, me too. I thought that was awesome. I was a huge Beatles fan. That's interesting. I got to talk with Scarlett Page a couple episodes back on the podcast. She's a photographer and her dad is Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin. And we were talking and I was asking her about, you know, what was it like growing up listening to music and what was the relationship like with you and your dad? And she was like, well, I had Duran Duran all over my wall and my dad was cool. And when he would listen to it and he really liked it and we got to talk about it. And I was like, man, that is so cool. And Paul McCartney made me think of that. You know, you got these guys that have not their, they certainly weren't past their heyday, but they weren't the front runners like Duran Duran was at this point. So it's cool to hear them encouraging them and Paul specifically encouraging them. The song Save a Prayer is one of my favorite ones. The more and more I listen to this record, is there any story from that song that sticks out to you?
You know, and that's another really great one that really shows kind of the band's songwriting, you know, and mm-hmm. that came out of Nick Rhodes and Andy Taylor. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned Jimmy Page because Andy Taylor was and is a rocker. You know, he had a much different kind of set of influences that he brought to Duran Duran. He had already gone on tour in the 70s. Like he saw the Van Halen Black Sabbath tour of England in 78, which is like the like massive tour everyone still talks about. And he, you know, he was really a fan of like, you know, Keith Richards and Gary Moore. Like he was definitely kind of the blues rock tradition. So, you know, so that was a song that he came up with. So that was another thing that this happened in Birmingham. You know, Nick Rhodes went to the studio one day that was like the practice space and he had a new keyboard that he was trying out and just kind of, you know, messing around with. He said he doesn't like to read manuals. And I was like, I completely understand that. That's very relatable. And he was fooling around with something and Andy Taylor heard it and came down and put some like, you know, a guitar on it. And the song was kind of built that way. And what's really interesting is that there is, I think it's floating around online, but there's actually a demo of the song that was at the studio in Birmingham. They ended up taking it to another studio then after they did it to kind of test it out. And it's amazing how close it is to the final. Like it's very, that was another one they just really nailed right on, just like the bones of the song. And, but it shows that, you know, Nick and Andy, it's very interesting because they're, you know, I talking to Andy, he had some
Hello?
That's really a secret early.
Oh, can you hear me?
Yep. Can you hear me?
Sorry, you cut out right when you said talking to Andy.
Okay.
So sorry.
I'll start talking about that then. So that was one of the interesting things talking to Andy, is that, you know, he was talking about the musicality of Duran Duran and how he and Nick kind of came from opposite directions, but they really kind of fit together. And I loved him telling me that, because that it made the record and it made Duran Duran early on make so much more sense to me as well. You know, just because they came from opposite directions, but because they did, it really came up with things that were really, really unique. And, you know, Nick and Andy, and it's, you know, I think it's no secret that, you know, if you read any articles about them, or, you know, you read Andy's book, like they didn't get along as it went on. Like, they just had personality clashes and things like that. But musically, they made magic together at that point. And, you know, and that really, there was really something special to that kind of chemistry at that stage and at the ages they were, that really came together on a lot of songs on this record.
Well, yeah, it's cool that you got to not only write the book, but actually interact with the band members. And outside of the things we've talked about, is there any you know, thing that came up that you were, thought was the most interesting, or just a cool addition to the album?
Oh, man. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You know, I talked to 4 out of the 5 band members, and I was so gratified by that, because, you know, the band have talked about Rio so much over the years. And I mean, they could have just basically said, you know, I think we're good, but they took the time to talk to me. And first off, I was just like so thrilled, because it really added a fresh perspective that really helped me see the record differently and really helped kind of direct the framework of the book. But I knew also what I wanted to do with the book was I wanted to talk to as many people involved with the album as possible. So I talked to Malcolm Garrett, who did a lot of the graphic design for the band early on, including the Rio cover. But he did a lot of the graphic design for their first album cycle too. If you look at the singles and things like that, like that's his handiwork. And even after that, he did a ton of the merchandising, and a lot of the imagery from that era is all him. So he's a genius. He worked with like Buzzcocks and Magazine. I mean, he is just amazing. And so he had some amazing things to say. I talked to Andy Hamilton, who did the Rio sax solo. I mean, you can't write a book about Rio without talking to him. But he was fabulous too. And I talked to Andy Earle, who took the band photo of, you know, the band in their trench coats on top of a building. And so, and he's worked with them a little bit over the years too. And so those are, I guess, 3 of the people that were just like, it was just so great to talk to them. Because they were just, you know, they added so much, and again, really kind of helped me understand the record better, and just really gave insights that really added, kind of making the 3-dimensional story of the record almost.
Love it. I love it. All right. The last question, how did Rio set up the remainder of the band's career? Like how did this launch them into what was next for them?
That's a great question. So, I mean, I think we talked about how Rio, you know, was popular in the UK early on, you know, right away. And it finally became popular in America. That really set the stage for them just kind of blowing up worldwide. You know, when they became popular in 1983 in the US, it basically set them on this like explosive, like Beatlemania-esque course. They had 3 studio albums on the Billboard charts by the end of 1983. Rio helped their debut become popular, which, you know, propelled Girls on Film back on MTV. Mm. They by the end of the year, they had 7 and the Ragged Tiger out, which was also a massive hit. And so they came to America in 1984 and had this huge arena sold out tour that was also actually very cutting edge. They had used video technology, and it was like one of the first tours that really was trying to do something different too. So it really kind of cemented their fandom, and it cemented their kind of their fan base in America. And they remained loyal. And I think that's what's so interesting, is that, you know, you meet so many people now who are like, I've been a fan for 40 years. And, you know, I still support them. Like, new record's coming. Okay, I got to pre-order it. And so it just really, you know, because the record was so special, because the record resonated with teenagers, and, you know, because when you're a teenager, the stuff you listen to, that's what sticks with you. That's what sticks with you for the rest of your life. Right. And, you know, there's happy memories. And even if you don't revisit everything, you know, all the time, it's still there kind of, you know, lurking as something very special. And so I think Duran Duran plays that role for a lot of people still. And so I think that, you know, there's happy memories associated with it. And so that really, you know, there's a lot of fondness for it. And I think that element too, I think really helps set them up too.
Well, that's great. And yeah, I totally get it. Anytime you can imprint your life with a soundtrack of something, that soundtrack sticks with you, with, and that memory follows you. And like you said, the love for those bands that you have as a teenager just follow you your whole life. So Andy, I greatly appreciate you coming on, sharing stories from your book. The book is 33 and a third, Duran Duran's Rio. And the links are going to be in the show notes for people that are interested. Thank you so much for coming on the show to chat today.
Thank you so much. This has been great. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Songs of Note podcast. Be sure and subscribe so you don't miss an episode. See you next time.